May it please the court, Nick Lerner for appellants. There is one fact which should completely dispose of this appeal. As the court well knows, after judgment was entered, the other side failed to file its motion for JNOV within 30 days. The motion was filed on the 34th day. Under these circumstances, the trial court had absolutely no jurisdiction to grant the JNOV. Everything that happened thereafter should have been annulled. Should have been of no effect.
The judgment that you're referring to has the title judgment. When you read the body of the judgment, it doesn't have the normal language that would be inclusive of an award of a judgment, and in fact it refers to taking the motion for directed verdict under advisement. So we look at the four corners, and I know that subsequently Judge Dean referred to it as a judgment. So how do we construe the document in light of all those circumstances?
Your Honor, it did have most, if not all, of the elements of a final judgment after a jury verdict. It did state it was a judgment. It was signed by His Honor. It was filed. And it even recited the awarding of costs.
Yes, but it, by its very express terms, it qualified itself. It said, I'm entering this judgment contingent upon the determination of the issues pertaining to directed verdict.
May I respond to you as both in this way? Yes, His Honor, Judge Dean, did say he's deferring the rulings on the directed verdict motion.
Well, wait, but can I? Go ahead. I'll address you later.
What he was saying under the law is he's denying the directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's evidence. He's denying it at the close of all evidence.
No, he didn't say that. He says he's expressly reserving that.
In effect, he was reserving the option of reconsidering it, and in some sense, in one or two ways, proceeding to, in effect, grant it. He had three options.
What you're saying, I think your argument, assume we were to agree with your argument for present purposes, that you really can't retain the right to rule on a motion for directed verdict after defense counsel's presented evidence and so forth, and what he should have said was that he didn't have that authority. In fact, he said he was keeping a motion under advisement. How can opposing counsel then have notice that this is a final judgment as to which post-trial motions have to be filed?
He never said under advisement. He never used language that was used in another case. But if I may finish, he had some options, and this is what he was in effect saying. He didn't say deny, Your Honor. He was in effect saying, I will reconsider this, and I'll either grant it sometime during the trial, I'll either grant it after the verdict is rendered when I issue my judgment, or I will wait until after the judgment is, in effect, rendered and entered, and within the 30 days, either on my own, sua sponte, on my own motion, I will take the verdict away, or I will respond when the other side files its motion. His Honor, Judge Dean, invited the other side to file post-trial motions. He did it in that judgment. He did it directly at the end of the case, and this is not in the record, Your Honor, but after the verdict was entered, counsel approached the bench.
If it's not in the record, probably we shouldn't address it.
May I make a point with respect,
yes,
and a question with respect to Rule 7201B?
Yes.
The one that says motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict. I've always understood that you had to make a motion for a directed verdict prior to the case going to the jury as a predicate to making the motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict.
Yes, because the JNOV has to be ruled based upon what you raised previously.
That's correct. So, and in effect, what you're doing is you're saying that the case should be taken away from the jury. You have to lay that as a groundwork before you give it to the jury, and then you take it away by ruling on a motion for the judgment notwithstanding the verdict, which is the same motion but with a different name. And by the way, the feds have relabeled them all motion for judgment because it's really the same motion, isn't it?
Yes.
So the question is whether or not because it says that whenever such motion, that is a motion for directed verdict at the close of all the evidence, is denied or for any reason is not granted, the court is deemed to have submitted the action to the jury subject to later determination of the legal questions raised by the motion. And then it goes on to say not more than 30 days later. And I think that's the argument you're making, isn't it? That
my argument is the trial judge had lots of flexibility, lots of opportunity to take away the verdict. But if he didn't do it within the 30th day after he entered his judgment.
I mean, the motion to take away the verdict wasn't made within the 30 days.
And if the motion wasn't made within the 30, he could have done it on his own motion, Your Honor. Or he could have responded to a motion filed in timely fashion by the other side.
Certainly the better practice would be to rule on the motion for directed verdict when it is filed and submitted and argued.
Yes.
But I don't see anything in the rules that prohibits the trial court from taking that motion under advisement. Now, that's not the better practice, as I say, but he's clearly doing that and preserving those issues. So, and it is inarguable. But I don't see anything in the rules that prohibits him from doing it.
Your Honor, if that were the case,
no.
If that were the case, the trial judge could sit on the jury verdict for a year, 2 years, 3 years before ruling.
We have time limits on that.
Well,
they're filing motions for new trial and things seem denied and so forth.
But he didn't do any of those things. He waited for the other side to file in time and fashion, which he had invited them to do, and they didn't do it. And he didn't do it on his own motion. So it's too late.
Well, and the time limits referred to by Judge Stith are for after-trial motions, not for ruling on taking a case under advisement. So if it's not a final judgment, there are no time limits.
His Honor, Judge Deans, never said he was taking this case under advisement. In effect, what he said was, I will deny it now, in effect. I will deny it now, subject to rethinking it after I hear what the verdict is. And then either I'll take it away, or I'll consider taking it away, or I'll rule if the other side files a timely motion for me to take it away. That's
if we don't follow the timetables, we'll end up with the same kind of problems we have in this case with people dying and this whole case going away.
You have to have expediency. It has to be done quickly. And he did enter his judgment a few days after the verdict.
Can you address, assume for present purposes we were to agree with the argument you're making now, do you get to make it? Because are you even in the appellate court to make it?
Yes.
Opposing counsel says you're not because you're probably substituted.
For reasons. Before any attempt to deprive me of the appeal was made, I had filed before Dr. Brasker died. I did try to substitute the estate, a person representing the estate. I filed within the 90 days. I filed in timely fashion. Through some quirks, I needed to replace the representative that I filed when I found out that representative, contrary to what I led to believe.
By her lawyer.
That they would enter the jurisdiction.
I was misled,
and therefore I should have been able to replace it at some time.
Is there a distinction? Because the parties seem to disagree on this, but they don't directly address case law on it, between agreeing to accept service and agreeing to waive objections to jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor, there is a distinction.
But I
was misled into thinking that both were going to happen, and that's unfortunately what happened.
So are you making an estoppel argument? Or how is, assuming you were misled or excusable neglect and so forth, opposing counsel says this is not one of the rules that allows us to consider that.
Here is the argument. Under this peculiar circumstance, when I was misled, I quickly sought leave to substitute another personal representative within 7 days of learning that she would not enter the jurisdiction. I was within the 9-month period in the statute. I was beyond the 90 days because it was a few days beyond the 90 days. But I did everything I could do, and in the court's equity, this court's inherent powers of equity, to get to the merits, I argue that it should, this court should allow me to substitute the estate. And here's another very important reason. For the last almost 2 years, even though Dr. Prochaska died almost 2 years ago, the other side has been taking positions on her behalf without authority. That's the Arbeitman rule. And they've been acting as if substitution either occurred or should occur, and they're opposing substitution in the same breath. They cannot have it both ways. They cannot try to keep me from proceeding with this appeal as if a substitution occurred, and then on their side proceed to represent a party who died 2 years ago. In effect, substitution should have been allowed. It should be allowed now.
If it shouldn't be allowed, and if they can't do it, who's going to make that argument against it?
The
court doesn't file briefs on its own. How's the court, or how's this court? Who would be the opposing party in this court?
A substitution of the estate should have occurred.
No, but if someone says it shouldn't, or if it wasn't allowed, how do we get the two parties here?
Two answers. If they wanted to raise it, the other side, they should have substituted, or agreed to substitution, or they should have consented to my substitution, or they should not oppose my substitution. Substitution by either of the parties is the result, is the remedy here. And that's the normal procedure, and that's what should have happened.
I'm having trouble with another concept. How does the estate, whose representative is in Kansas, I believe, right?
Virginia. Yes.
But it's the estate of a doctor who was practicing in Missouri and sued in Missouri. And did she die in Kansas or in Missouri? She was a resident of Kansas.
I'm sure she was a resident of Johnson County, Kansas, when she died. I don't know where she actually died.
But I don't understand the objection to jurisdiction.
You don't understand?
I don't understand how they can object to Ms. Grossman being substituted as the representative. She is the representative of the estate of the person who has been sued and is before the court in Missouri.
Yes.
I guess I'm asking the wrong person.
I'll let you ask the other side, but I think the case law supports their position that a party who is a non-resident within the state of Missouri.
But they're a party only to the extent that they represent the interests of the deceased person prior to her death before the court in Missouri.
I agree with that. And I'll add one wrinkle, even though my time is up. There's a malpractice carrier that obviously stands behind Dr. Prochaska. That is a Missouri resident, and that's where we're trying to go. And that's another reason why it should have been allowed.
Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Kleppner, could you start where we ended, which is on the substitution of parties? The rule, explain it to me as to what was required of them, because the language is such motion together with the notice of hearing shall be served upon the parties as provided in Rule 4301 and upon persons not parties in the matter. So who are they referring to when there is a deceased party, and who are the persons, not parties, that have to be served?
To answer your last question, Judge Gregory, I believe the parties not before the court, as per that rule, would be the proposed substitute respondent. In this case, we're dealing with...
But how can... how does the person who is giving the notice of death... I mean... how do they know who is going to be the proper person to represent the decedent?
Well, I think there's several answers to that question in this case. Mr. Lerner, as he's known this all along, is the malpractice carrier was before the court. It's subject to the jurisdiction of the Missouri courts. He's also referenced the gentleman who...
But the malpractice insurer isn't a party.
No, but the malpractice carrier could be a substitute respondent. So that he was on notice of that fact. And was on notice of the fact the carrier was subject to the jurisdiction of courts, and by statute in Missouri could have added that part. So he was on notice of that fact.
Can he convert this into an action direct action against the insurer because of the death of the insured?
There is a statute in Missouri, and I apologize for not having the number exactly, but there's a statute that does permit where an insured interest is directly at issue that insurer can step into the shoes of its insurer. And so, if the insurance company does insure an interest that's the subject of the lawsuit, the carrier could have been a substitute.
And has that statute been used in a case where there's a death? Has that been a circumstance in Missouri law where a death is the circumstance that allows the insurer to step into the shoes of the insured?
There's none that I'm aware of, but I don't know that for a fact.
So are you using this? Because there is a good point being made also that who's defending this case against his suggestion of death? Because if the person's dead, then their counsel's dead, and who do you serve? I mean, who's not so much who does he serve, but then who's representing that interest to dismiss his claim?
I'm representing it.
But as an, how?
What's your authority to do so?
My authority is Holmes. I think we cited the same case. My authority, if you're asking my authority to dismiss the claim,
right.
My authority is as a person in interest under the rule.
Representing?
Representing. That's the anomaly. We're 633 days after the suggestion of death, and no party has been subject.
Since your client is deceased, how do you have anyone to represent now? How do you have any authority to file on behalf of a party?
I don't represent anybody.
Well, that's exactly right.
I will concede that.
I'll see you later then.
That is exactly why, under the rule, we have 90 days to get the parties before the court and to allow the courts to proceed with their business.
But I still go back to the first sentence or the second sentence in Rule 5213A1 is that you have to give suggestions of debt. And in this case, there was an out-of-state personal representative that had already been appointed. Is that correct?
Yes, an out-of-state is a Virginia resident acting as the executrix in a Kansas state.
But there could be heirs. The personal representative could not be appointed. What is the law as to who the suggestions of death should be given to? Notice of
the suggestion of death filed by me, which is at home because that must be served on the appellant. And that puts him on notice.
Then he files the motion for substitution of parties.
Exactly.
And who does he substitute if there's no, if letters have not been issued or is state?
Malpractice carrier. And he's mentioned Frank McCollum, who is acting as the defendant ad litem in the other malpractice cases pending in Missouri.
So you're saying a defendant ad litem, if there's no estate yet set up, a defendant ad litem can be appointed?
Exactly. And that's what's happened in the other cases that appellant has referenced. And I would note that had happened before his 90-day jurisdictional window expired. The anomaly of what we have in this case is that appellant is suggesting that the Missouri Court of Appeals had jurisdiction, that he secured the jurisdiction of the Missouri Court of Appeals by asking that same court to exceed its jurisdiction.
Now, wait a minute. You're asked, all that was being asked is that the estate of the deceased be substituted as the party, and the estate of the deceased is, for the purpose of this action, represented by the company that's paying your bill. So why is there not jurisdiction in Missouri for that?
There isn't jurisdiction currently because you're outside the 90 days to substitute.
No. Within the time that motion was made. We're talking about correcting error within the time that 90 days.
Say it was perfected within the 90 days.
If he had done that within 90 days, I believe
he did. He did make the motion within 90 days to substitute the estate, did he not?
He moved to substitute, yes, Susan Grossman, who was acting, which is something that no Missouri court can do. That is
why not?
The Rooney case.
Why not?
It's a case from this court that Missouri
no, why not?
Do not have jurisdiction over out-of-state.
Well, wait a minute. The out-of-state estate is being represented in the litigation by your malpractice carrier. Why doesn't a Missouri court have jurisdiction over that entity, over that estate, for the purpose of completing a malpractice action against a decedent who is practicing in Missouri and who is insured? And I assume that even though you say you represent no one, somebody's paying your bill to be here, or else you wouldn't be here.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the answer to your question, very simply, is that estate is a Kansas estate.
Pardon?
And the answer to your question is that it is a Kansas estate. Missouri court.
And why doesn't Missouri have jurisdiction to continue an action and have the estate, even though it's a Kansas estate, substituted where there is a malpractice carrier who is, in fact, the party that the person that has the financial interest in the litigation and is, in fact, making the representations? You wouldn't have any authority these last 600 days to do anything unless there was that carrier in here.
The carrier could have been substituted. And to answer your question,
but it's normally not. I mean, you couldn't think of an instance where that had actually been done.
No, I couldn't.
Neither can I.
No.
Okay.
So the bottom line is that the appellant is asking this court, though, to condone a rule under 52.13 that would effectively gut the rule.
Let me ask you a question, because the rule provides that there's 90 days in which to file the motion to substitute parties. And there is case law that says that 90 days is absolute and cannot be extended. And then the consequence of not filing it is the action is dismissed without prejudice.
That's correct.
So what's the impact of that? Where does that leave them?
That would leave appellant with a dismissal without prejudice, and presumably he would then have to refile with the Court of Appeals to file an appeal out of time. That's where I believe it would be.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to Judge Wolf's. I'm not sure I understand now. How is it that Missouri courts cannot obtain jurisdiction over a Kansas estate?
That is precisely addressed by the Brady case.
Yeah. It basically explain the rationale of the Brady.
Issues of territorialism. There's U.S. Supreme Court precedent on that as well, that you only have jurisdiction over the state of Missouri.
They could consent to jurisdiction.
And there was no consent.
Yeah, I understand.
But the
personal representative could have consented to the Missouri jurisdiction.
If there was a consent to jurisdiction, I think you're correct. But I should also point out that there was no consent.
That this, what's the name of the person?
Grossman.
Yeah, Grossman. Grossman, who's the representative.
That's the case he's going back to.
What happens if there's no consent? Is there a way to get long arm jurisdiction then over an out of state estate? No.
Not that I'm aware of.
So you would have to have a malpractice carrier defendant ad litem and then file the judgment in Kansas against the estate. That would be.
And I think you made a good point earlier.
The estate has the duty under Kansas law to represent to get the assets and the liabilities of the deceased person squared away. And one of the assets and one of the liabilities is this litigation.
I can't disagree with that, but my response would be
and to that extent may have extraterritorial effect.
Now, they can fight Missouri jurisdiction any way they can. They can fight any kind of claim against the estate.
Absolutely.
That's one of their duties too, I suppose.
One of the duties that my responsibility of appellant. Appellant said he's making this argument, excusable neglect. Under the Holmes case, it is the duty of the appellant to secure the jurisdiction of the court. We also, when we're talking about being misled, there is no factual support for that in the record. And I have to say that wasn't by anybody but me or mine. There is no excusable neglect under Rule 52.13. And Rule 44 says that.
So how should they have proceeded? One, by suing the med malpractice carrier, the other is by a defendant ad litem, and how does that work?
All petition the court? All had to do was, within the 90 days, move to substitute either the carrier or Frank McCollum, who has apparently been identified by appellant. If that motion was served, and he's on notice as to both of those issues, if that motion had been served within 90 days, he was...
And what is the procedure to obtain a defendant ad litem?
I presume to get the willingness of Mr. McCollum to serve as such.
What's the significance of the fact that the Kansas personal representative indicated that they would submit to the jurisdiction of the state of Missouri? And legally, is there some relief available to him because of that?
I wanted to correct the point, because I think Judge Stiff raised that. They did not agree. And I've never seen any letters to this effect, so there is no record before the court on that. But if that happened, my understanding of what they agreed to was to accept service of a paper, not to submit to the jurisdiction of the Missouri courts. And I believe there is a valid distinction between that. Accepting service of a motion to substitute is not a wholesale consent to submitting to the jurisdiction of any court in the state of Missouri. It is a very big difference. And very clearly, from what I read in the appellant's brief, again with no factual support, is that they took the position that they weren't going to submit.
There was no factual record made below about what kind of statements were made by the attorney for the deceased and or for the estate and so forth. No factual record was
there
developed.
There is not a single bit of factual.
Okay. We don't have letters or agreements or anything.
Nothing.
Okay.
Let me ask you a quick question. Is that this is very perplexing, as you can tell, at least from my brothers and sisters. Is the general knowledge, the legal profession, a significant number of lawyers who practice in Missouri live in Kansas. If they commit legal malpractice, I mean, there's no way of getting to them because they live in Kansas. Their estates will be in Kansas. I mean, that's because they live in Kansas. I mean, and there's no legal. Same would be true, I'm sure, about doctors. A significant number of doctors live in fancy places in Kansas and work in Missouri.
Missouri has fancy places, too.
But there are a lot of fancy places in Kansas.
Just Tom, I believe your question is, if you commit a tort in the state, then you are subject to the jurisdiction. But then if you subsequently die, you have to follow Rule 5213. And you have to get proper party before. You don't have to get the party before the court, but you have to serve a motion to substitute, which requests substitution of a proper party within the 90 days.
And what they did was they substituted the... They asked to substitute the personal representative who was appointed by the court in Kansas after a lawyer representing that personal representative said that they would accept service.
That's based on the argument in appellant's brief, and that's my understanding. Again, I've never seen anything to that effect, but I think you're correct.
But Judge Teitelman was just positing the question that if you commit a tort and then die, and your estate's in Kansas, under your theory of jurisdiction, the estate cannot be sued.
That's what the Rooney case says. And there has to be a substitute
out
respondent
of luck.
That is subject to
you're just out of luck.
Possibly.
Well, you're saying you can get a substitute defendant and then file against the state in Kansas, file your judgment. You're not saying you can't continue it. It's just you can't actually continue it against the state directly. You would have to find some other substitute defendant.
Exactly
not that you'd
correct.
Have to dismiss out the suit. I don't
exactly
think you're
correct.
Saying.
You just cannot substitute as the party standing in the shoes of Dr. Prohaska here, someone who's beyond the jurisdiction of this court.
Now, the death occurred while the case was on appeal.
Yes.
So the fact that there's no record made would likely be because you don't generally make a factual record in the Court of Appeals.
That's true. You may answer to the service issue.
Uh-huh.
Yes. But there's also no record before this court that is in the legal file appendix, et cetera, to substantiate any of this excusable neglect argument, which doesn't exist, by the way, under. That's the Gillespie case.
The case law that says that the 90-day time period is absolute and cannot be extended. Is that case law from this court, or is it from the Intermediate Court of Appeals?
It's from the Intermediate Court of Appeals. So at the end of the day, though, we are 633 days out. We can't have
not from the filing of a motion.
I'm sorry?
Not from the filing of a motion.
From the filing of the suggestion of death. That's what I'm counting against. We're 633.
No, but he made a motion to substitute, and then he made another motion to substitute. Within 90 to 97 days or someplace from there. Right?
That's correct. So from that motion to substitute,
well,
the
600 days occurs because we've been out on appeal for all this.
That's correct.
Where you've been representing no one.
I represent the interests, which is what Holmes permits me to do.
What interest are you representing here today?
I represent the interests of my deceased client.
And what does Holmes say about that?
Holmes says that I remain a person in interest following the death of my client. And that's exactly why Holmes permitted a suggestion of death. I will agree there's a difference in the pleading. But Holmes says, and the rule says itself, that lawyers remain persons in interest. And that's the difference between what happens in the federal system and in the Missouri system.
And for what purposes do they remain? For how long or until a substitute is accepted? Yeah. Or
until there is a proper substitution.
Any other questions?
I have one more. We have another case coming up right after yours on suggestions of death. And in that case, they've cited that the attorney of the decedent cannot be served. Is that at odds with the statement that you just made, that there is law that indicates that you continue to serve the interests of the party?
I think the attorney, if the attorney is a person in there, I think the attorney should be served, and that's what in fact happened here. So if I remain a person in interest, and I defended my client for 6 years preceding that, I shouldn't be expected to sit on my hands.
So the argument in the next case in which they will address, they can prepare their answers now, is that once your client is deceased, you're not representing anybody, so you can't accept service, a suggestions of death on their behalf, and therefore you haven't given notice that is sufficient to trigger the 90-day time limit.
What's your lawyer-client relationship? How do you communicate with your client?
And you can answer both of those at the same time.
Judge, I wish I had an answer. Well, I do not.
Do you disagree with that? That the point being that you can't represent the person substituted, and therefore service on the attorney does not start the 90 days running.
No, the suggestion of death is what starts the 90 days.
You might want to stay around and hear the next argument, because that issue is coming up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I have a question. Why is it that there's clearly a couple of ways that you could have done this to avoid all of the concern, and one was to what is the person's name who's the defendant ad litem in three other cases?
McCollum?
Yes. I mean, was that person not available to substitute as a party as a defendant ad litem?
We, meaning I, felt that the person who is appointed by the probate court that would be handling the estate would be the most appropriate person. And we waited until the 85th day, and then when she was appointed, we appointed her.
But, you know, if nobody had been appointed, because you have a lot longer, what if it had been that 90th day, no one had been appointed? What would you have done?
We would have appointed someone else. Okay. We would have gone ahead and done something before the 90th day.
Why did it take you so long to, as I understand it, you never actually tried to substitute Mr. McCollum for months or years? I mean, you waited an extended period.
And there's still an allegation that you still don't have anybody identified. Now, that's a real problem.
We can answer this first.
Who had already been serving, apparently, I found out.
At whose behest?
On other cases for this defendant.
At whose behest? At the behest of another.
At the substituted party for a defendant in malpractice case.
But was he appointed at the suggestion of the plaintiff's lawyer in those cases?
I do not know the answer to that.
Because I've dealt with situations like that, and we just got another lawyer, unrelated, without any authority, to be appointed defendant ad litem. That's what happened.
That's what we would have done by the 90th day if the estate...
Somebody in your office.
Certainly.
But how could that be if he has no authority?
Somebody in the office down the hall.
Well, no, that's somebody in my office.
Somebody in the office down the hall.
Correct. I would have done that, but they, in the probate proceeding, were delaying. I was watching that probate proceeding. And they finally got it to court on the 85th or so day. And I went, and I observed, and that lady was appointed. And I immediately asked, as I told the court, if they would accept, and they said yes.
Is that in our record?
No.
You're asking us to make a decision here and to grant equitable relief based on something that's not in the record. Didn't you have an opportunity? But there's no opportunity, certainly, in the appellate court to make it. But shouldn't you have remanded? I find it very difficult when we've got a he said, she said, and nothing's in the record, and even the parties are not before us.
Yeah, because you're really asking for a good faith exception.
I understand the court's concern. I represented in papers before.
Or you didn't ask for a master to be appointed to look into this or anything?
I didn't. But I represented to the courts, for appeals and this court, in papers as well as in this brief, that the statement was made to me by the counsel for Ms. Grossman that he would accept service. It has never been objected to. They did raise the fact that there's no record on it, but it has never been objected to.
And that is?
Well, that's an objection.
Yeah.
But you never served him? I mean, I remember Dave Fuel saying, I'm not going to take it to full judgment. Then they take it to full judgment. Sorry, you just took their representation. That doesn't mean anything. I mean, you never served them.
Well, we served them informally. We did not serve them formally. But they accepted that service.
But they didn't agree to waive jurisdiction when they did that.
They alerted me at the time when this all arose that they would not take a position on entering into the jurisdiction.
If we were opposing counsel in part argues that if we were to accept your argument that a motion for substitution, which tries to substitute an inappropriate party, nonetheless is timely and if it falls within the 90 days and you can then amend it later on to eventually bring in the substitute party, there's two questions I have related to that. One is, I don't say that you've done it or did it in a timely manner immediately afterwards once you found that out. And the second is, I just am really struck by the parallel between your two arguments. Somewhat ironic that you're arguing that they failed to file it timely and that there wasn't an excuse, and that if we grant this extension on the JNOV, then people could just leave motions pending for years and years. And they're arguing as to yours that if we consider the improper motion but timely filed, and you can keep amending it to get a proper party, that could go on for years. And I'm just, it's very interesting that both sides are arguing the same thing, really, about the other's argument.
I have a quick response. I raise the request to replace Ms. Grossman as a personal representative within 7 days after I learned that Ms. Grossman would not enter the appearance. I did that within 7 days.
But you didn't give him a person. You just said, I'd like to. But you have to actually...
Another pleading in my motion for rehearing the Court of Appeals, then I asked for that.
And how long was that after the original 90 days?
It was a couple months, two or three months.
And what is the consequence to your client if... because the substitution of death, the motion to substitute wasn't filed within the 90 days, if there is a dismissal without prejudice?
The consequence is the judgment granted by Judge Dean withdrawing the verdict stands, and he didn't have any jurisdiction.
Your opponent argues that you could go to the Western District and ask leave of court to file an appeal out of time. Is that a remedy that would solve the problem if you're dismissed for failure to substitute a party?
Because it says without prejudice.
I know about the without prejudice. It would assist, and we would proceed if we were permitted to do so.
Because my question is, normally you would think that that's a dismissal without prejudice of the action, so you could just refile the action. But when it's on appeal and a judgment has been rendered, can you reinstate the appeal if it's been dismissed?
I found no case law to answer that question, and I've been trying to find case law to answer that question.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.